This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. There's an expression we hear more often these days as it relates to the LGBTQ community. Love is love. It's an affirmation that just because someone loves differently than you, that does not make their love less real or valid than yours. But how many forms of love can you really accept? The limits of that might run right up to the kind of relationship one listener described in our inbox.
I am 54 years old, and my husband and I have been married since I was 20. I am in a polyamorous relationship. My significant other is 11 years older than I am, and we have been together for 8 years. Our families are very close. We've vacationed together more than a dozen times. I fear coming out as being a member of the polyamorous community as it's not recognized as normal as the LGBT community is. I would appreciate any feedback on this and how to gain acceptance in this age of my life and still be able to love my husband and my significant other. Thank you.
Polyamory, the capacity for loving more than one person in various possible ways, is slowly coming out of its own closet. The potential benefits of disclosure can be great, including finding the kinds of loving, sustainable connections that affirm who you really are, not just who others say you're supposed to be. The risks? Well, they can be high. What does it take to make a polyamorous relationship work? Is it just a way of excusing infidelity or indecisiveness? And is maintaining such a complex network of connections really worth it? Joining us from Eugene, Oregon is Janet W. Hardy, someone who you might say literally wrote the book on polyamory. It is called The Ethical Slut, a practical guide to polyamory, open relationships, and other freedoms in sex and love. Janet, welcome to 1A.
Hi, glad to be here.
Joining us from Chattanooga, Tennessee is Elizabeth Sheff, a sociologist at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and a relationship consultant. She is the author of The Polyamorists Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families. Eli, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Janet, let me start with you. What is your ideal relationship structure?
I don't have one. An ideal relationship structure is a structure that works for the people in the relationship. If you want to know what I'm in an open marriage. We're both of an age where we're not doing a lot of sex anymore, but it's there for us if we want it. And we've been together 13 years now. All good.
How do you define your sexual orientation, Janet?
Bisexual.
Okay, so are you married to a man or a woman?
A bisexual man. We're both genderqueer, so it gets a little complicated.
What is it about that relationship that works for you, that satisfies you?
I have a very strong nesting streak, and for me to be happy in a relationship, I need someone who shares that with me. We spend a lot of time working on the house, making it the way we want it to be. We have chickens. I bake bread. It's very mellow.
What about the other people outside of the, if I can call it just the nucleus of your relationship, of your marriage? Can you describe what the organizational chart kind of looks like for me?
What day is today?
It's like that, huh?
Kind of, sort of. My longest term relationship is with my co-author, Dossie Easton. We have been friends and collaborators and lovers for not quite 30 years now. And then I have other relationships that are variously more intellectual, more erotic, you know, just all over the map. I'm a complex person, and I lead a complex relationship life.
Is there anything that all these relationships, with all their complexities, is there anything that they all have in common?
Open-mindedness, self-awareness, at least a little bit of grounding in how open relationships can work. I don't want to spend my personal life explaining this to people. I spend my work life explaining this to people, so I want to have people in my life who are kind of hip to it already.
Understandable. And before I come to Eli Sheff, how many people are in your personal network right now, Janet, total?
Oh, Lord. One of the things that happens when you get away from monogamy is that the different relationships in your life all crystallize not according to who you're having sex with, but according to how you relate to them. So, you know, the relationships in my life include my kids and my friends and my spouse and my co-author and my exes, who are not all very ex. It's just that I don't live near them anymore. And you just stop trying to rank them. I certainly spend the most time with my spouse. I spend the most of my work life with my co-author. I spend a lot of time with my kids when I can. It's all, my life is a giant Google Calendar page.
I hear that. Lots and lots of organization. Before I come to Eli Sheff, Janet, first of all, thank you for being so open about the life that you live. I know that no one is owed that information. You choose to talk about it, but I just want to affirm that this is personal. All right, Eli Sheff, let me bring you in. The basic definition of polyamory that we gave one at the top of the show, is there anything you would add to that definition?
I would say it's one of the most demanding versions of consensual non-monogamy currently in practice, in that it relies on partners really knowing each other and socializing and hanging out. So other forms of non-monogamy are more focused on sexual variety, and polyamory is one of the forms that focuses more so on emotional intimacy. So while the sexuality really stands out to people, it's what kind of grabs the headlines, my research shows that it's really not the most important thing.
How many people, Eli, are in polyamorous relationships? Do we have any sense of how prevalent it is?
It's hard to say exactly how many people are in polyamorous relationships specifically, but Terry Conley out of the University of Michigan has a team that's been doing some amazing research, and they have found that about 5% of people in the United States right now are in non-monogamous relationships, and about 20% of people over time have been in some kind of non-monogamous relationship at some point in their lives. So that is actually considerably more than the entire LGBT population combined.
Yeah, we've heard from a number of people who are in non-monogamous relationships. Eli, is being consensually non-monogamous the same as being polyamorous, or are they different?
They are. Polyamory is a form of consensual non-monogamy. So it's kind of under that larger umbrella. There are other forms of consensual non-monogamy. Probably one of the best known is swinging. There's a lot of monogamish people now. There's relationship anarchy, and there are open relationships. So all of those could fall under consensual non-monogamy.
And we'll work our way through some of the terminology as we continue our conversation. Janet, I know we got to pause in a minute, but what would you say are the one or two biggest misconceptions, biggest stereotypes you hear a lot about as it relates to polyamorous relationships?
That everybody who's doing polyamory or any of the consensually non-monogamous relationships is an old free love addict from the 60s and 70s, which is a hard one for Dossie and me to argue against since we are that. But our audiences are much more varied than we are. One of the questions we get a lot is, didn't we try this back in the 70s and it didn't work then? Which we did. And back then, there weren't books like ours or Eli's or any of the other excellent books out there about alternatives to monogamy. And the other is that we are all just getting our rocks off with all and sundry. We are the good time had by all. And some of us are and some of us aren't.
To that point, one of the members of the 1A Text Club wrote, I am learning a lot about myself, how to communicate openly, and I get to enjoy and receive and give support from and to more than one person versus hanging everything on a single person, which is not realistic. It takes a lot of communication, but I feel more comfortable with this than I did monogamy. It's not just a big sex fest. Trust me. If it were, I'd have quit my day job a long time ago. I do want to talk more about this ethical aspect of being an ethical slut, Janet. Some of the ethical considerations that go into polyamory, and we'll get to more of your questions and stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message for parents come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. And LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing polyamory. Before we bring in our next two guests, let me go through a few of your comments. And man, have you sent us comments and comments and comments, including plenty of your personal stories. Thank you so much for those. Eric emailed, "We have been a triad for 10 years, a couple married for 35 years, a straight woman and a bi man, and a gay man. We live together in a stable, harmonious relationship. The biggest tension in a decade was over what color to paint our house, resolved to everyone's satisfaction. How does it work so well? We value honesty and kindness with the trust that comes from those two things. It's really that simple. It helps to be trained in skillful communication." Artemisia tweeted, "Polyamory is hardly new or a revolution. It may be more of a revival. Millennials don't see it as a revolution, but as a natural part of human sexuality. I agree with them. It's not for everyone, but it's not abnormal. Some relationships need that balance." Eli, how do you see that comment? Is this something that millennials view differently than their parents as kind of an evolution rather than a revolution?
I would definitely say that younger people are more open to and more comfortable with various forms of non-monogamy. I think a lot of younger people aren't necessarily identifying as polyamorous because of what Janet mentioned earlier. It has this kind of aging hippie kind of reputation to it. I think a lot more younger people are either monogamish or open. But definitely, I would say that non-monogamy in general is on the rise, in part because monogamy has to be negotiated now in a way that it just used to be the default. And now a lot of people are having the relationship talk, you know, oh, we've been going out for a while. What are we up to? Or what is this relationship? Negotiating monogamy means sometimes you choose something else.
And another listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, "The key word here seems to be ethical, which is all that distinguishes people openly having multiple sex partners from people who secretly engage in adulterous trysts. It is a question of honesty and fidelity." Janet Hardy, I'd love you to respond to that, particularly because that's the title of the book, The Ethical Slut. I think for many people, the very idea of being or calling oneself a slut involves a severe lack of ethics.
Well, of course, that depends on how you define your ethics. I have a really simple definition for what is ethical in a relationship and what isn't, which is if you feel like you need to lie about it, you've got a problem. The thing that ties together all of us who are in various forms of consensual non-monogamy is a commitment to honesty, to telling our partners what we're up to and who with and why. It doesn't mean you have to have the Monday morning quarterbacking where you sit down and describe every lick and suck from your previous evening, but it does mean that everybody involved has to have all the information they need and has to have basically signed off on it.
Let's add two more voices to the conversation about the diversity within polyamorous relationships. Joining us from Los Angeles is Ron Young, the founder of Black and Poly, an organization for polyamorous black people. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Joshua. How you doing?
And joining us from WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte is Crystal Farmer, the editor of blackandpoly.org. Crystal, welcome.
Thank you.
Crystal, let me start with you. When did you realize that you were polyamorous?
I was in my mid-20s and just gotten out of college where I hadn't had any relationships. And I, like millennials do, I had a lot of casual sex. And I thought the sex was great, but I wanted to be able to have more friends than sex partners. So I started on this journey of exploring what it meant to be in a sexual relationship with someone, but also not go up what we call the relationship escalator. So I wasn't planning on moving in with anybody. I wasn't going to marry them. You know, I just wanted to enjoy our friendship.
Ron, what about you?
Mine started well over 10 years ago. I was working in the Silicon Valley, and, you know, this is back when they had the news groups and stuff on the internet. And I read up a lot about the polyamorous community, and the conversation actually was broached by my wife, Lisa. And it was really just asking questions, and I think she recognized my ability to love more than one person. I had the capacity to, and the conversation started back then.
So that must have been a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, it was one that it transpired over a number of years until about maybe 10 years ago where we finally opened up.
And what's the current structure, Ron, of your relationship or relationships? What does that look like?
I'm not so much in relationship structure that has hard edges like a quad or a triad. You know, you tend to bump into those edges and hurt yourself. Well, my experience has been that. So mine is more of like a wavy, undulating line, you know. And sometimes the ends are joined together. Sometimes they fall apart.
And just to be clear, Ron, when we're talking about a quad or a triad, you're talking about four people or three people who are all in relationship with one another in a more or less mutual way. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, a relationship structure. I can't say that I'm in a structure in particular. I usually just, you know, love the people that are in my life.
Crystal, what about you?
I'm solo poly, so that means that I consider myself my own primary. I have several relationships with people but I don't plan on marrying them. We don't share finances. We don't share co-parenting responsibilities. I do my thing, and then I'm relating to each person as an individual.
Crystal, then maybe you're the one to answer this question that came through our website, the1a.org. One listener writes, how is this different from dating multiple persons without being exclusive with any of them? Crystal?
So a lot of assumptions that come when you're dating is that eventually I'm going to cut off this person and I'm going to, you know, decide that there's this one person that I want to be with. So when you're dating, you say, I'm trying to find the one and I want to marry them. I want to have a big family. I want to introduce them to my parents. In polyamory, we don't necessarily use that as a metric or of how involved we are in relationships. I can have relationships with people where we're just having sexual relations or just people that are in my life as good friends, and I don't have to have any of them on some kind of scale that says, okay, well, you're more important because you live with me, or you're more important because, you know, you are helping with my finances. So there's different ways that we can structure our relationship. So instead of just dating to find a potential lover, we're dating to enjoy our relationships.
Crystal, two other things that I asked Janet that I should ask you is do all the people that you connect with in these various relationships and interactions, do they all have anything in common?
No. So all the people that I date are dating other people. Some of them are white, some of them are black, some of them are married, some of them are not. So they really don't have a big unifying thing between them.
And how do you describe your sexual orientation, Crystal?
I am bisexual.
Ron, what about you? How do you describe your sexual orientation?
I'm straight.
And do the people that you connect with, do they tend to have something in common?
Yeah, the people that I've learned just from coming into polyamory that you definitely swing towards a certain type.
A physical type?
More of a relationship type, you know, like a how they love. And it can be challenging when that's broken up a bit. But I welcome the challenge. A lot of times it teaches me something about myself.
One of our listeners asked, who is suited for a polyamorous lifestyle? Janet?
You have to have good self-awareness because in poly, if you're not honest with yourself, it becomes very difficult to be honest with everybody else. You need to have a good tolerance for a little bit of chaos, because there will be times when everybody's needs and commitments bump up against each other and you have to get it all sorted out. You have to be able to listen. If people are trying to tell you about something that is not working for them and your initial reaction is to fly into defensive mode, that's going to be a problem. So basically, you know, for me, these are the skills I would look for from anybody in my life, friend or lover, but they become particularly important when your edges are abutting so many other people's edges. You have to have a really good sense of where they end and you begin, because there's going to be a lot of places where that becomes important.
Shauna wrote on our Facebook page, most people think being monogamous means more relationship security, as if monogamy protects us from falling in love or lust with another person. If anything, I believe being poly is the only construct that allows you to maintain your existing family and relationship structure as you and your life changes over time. Contrast what Shauna wrote, which reads, my relationship of 10 years ended 3 weeks ago, because my wife decided that we should be polyamorous once she fell in love with a coworker. She began to lie about things mere weeks in. Crystal, why not just find one person who meets most of your needs and settle down?
Well, I would argue that I'm already settled down. I have a daughter, I have a job, I live in a house, and I am comfortable with my life, so...
But you know what I mean. Settle down in a relationship, in a conventional relationship.
I was married in an open relationship, but, you know, marriage wasn't for me. I like living alone and being on my own and having healthy relationships, so I don't see a reason to conform to the standards of monogamous society that says, okay, I can only love one person and I can only be with one person at a time.
How do you make sure that everyone in a polyamorous relationship is getting their needs met? Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
We often form assumptions about people we don't even know.
No one would assume that I spent half a decade training as a boxer, or that I recently learned to ski and I really love skiing.
And those assumptions are very often wrong.
And I'll tell you what people don't expect to see on ski slopes is a Black Muslim woman.
Ideas on the hidden biases that shape our world on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with Janet Hardy, Elizabeth Sheff, Crystal Farmer, and Ron Young. Let's get to a few more of your questions and comments. One listener of the 1A Text Club writes, I'm in an open relationship with a married couple. I'm not in a position to handle a long-term relationship, and the husband and wife love each other but have very busy schedules and different tastes as far as intimacy. I'm dating the husband. We go on dates and have a blast. Boundaries were set up front, and we all respect them. Weekends are their time together, and I never encroach. She gets priority, and I respect that and their desire to keep their relationship strong. At the same time, I never feel overlooked or uncared for. Janet Hardy, I'm glad we got this story because it gets right to something that we mentioned earlier, which is jealousy. And I'd love to get your take on this kind of compound question from the 1A Text Club. What level of jealousy is there? Do the original couple get married, or is another of the relationship the legal spouse? What's scheduling like? Is a duplex or other similar type of dwelling the best for this relationship type? I wonder, Janet, maybe if we just boil that whole multi-part question down into asking, how do you deal with jealousy in a polyamorous or consensually non-monogamous relationship?
I think one of the myths about poly people is that we don't feel jealous. Of course we do. We are humans. Anybody who's raised children or dogs knows that envy and jealousy are kind of built into the wiring. But the difference, I think, in consensual non-monogamy is we know that jealousy will come up and we have a commitment to surviving it. I think one of the myths in the monogamous world is that jealousy is the worst thing you can possibly feel and excuses all kinds of bad behavior. In poly, we recognize jealousy as a part of our lives and work out techniques for dealing with it, anything from asking our partners for help, talking it through, self-soothing with things that make us feel better when we're feeling jealous, whether that's the kind of workout that leaves you shaking and sweating, or whether it's a nice hot bath with bubbles, or however you like to deal with strong emotion. Most of us know that there are going to be times in our lives when we have difficult emotions, anger or grief or whatnot, and we know we will get through them. What poly people have done is added jealousy to that list. Yes, it feels terrible, and yes, it is survivable.
How do you deal with jealousy, Janet?
I am more of the shaking and sweating.
Oh, I should ask, I beg your pardon, how have you dealt with jealousy?
I am more of the shaking and sweating type. I like to find the dirtiest, filthiest part of my house and go throw things around and get filthy and sweat and make myself sore the next day and just kind of work it all out that way. Or so go to the gym, but that's less constructive.
And Eli Chef, I think we should be clear that there's all kinds of forms of jealousy. I mean, I could tell a horror story. I don't want to embarrass the people involved, but of a couple that fell apart because an open relationship involved one person who wanted an open relationship and another person who was open to a poly relationship, and that caused jealousy. This fear of not being primary, of not being first in the relationship, blew the whole thing up.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's, for some people, the lack of specialness is very difficult. And for other people, they have different partners that are special in different ways. But I absolutely think Janet nailed it when she said, you know, there's a range of ways to deal with it. And I really think that polyamory or non-monogamy is not for everyone. There are some people who are either monogamous by orientation or just don't want to share and shouldn't have to.
Ron, how do you deal with that in terms of making sure that everyone kind of knows their place, for lack of a better term, their place in a relationship so that people know who comes first or whether everyone comes equally? Like, how do you do that?
I don't juggle partners. I see my partners as almost, well, I see them as family members. I wouldn't do that with my kids. Or siblings, and so that's the overall general feel in my pod too. I think it's that you know, we just treat each other fairly, and I can't say equally because there are times where one partner may need something more. Maybe they're sick or going through something, and they need a little bit more attention. And everyone is aware of that, and it's usually encouraged. So that's usually the order of the day for my family.
Another member of our text club writes, I have a hard enough time keeping one wife happy. How the hell do you actually please multiple wives successfully? Janet Hardy, maybe you should respond to this, and we should be clear. Having multiple wives, bigamy or polygamy, is technically illegal in many states. So we're not talking about marrying multiple people. We're talking about having various relationships in different forms with multiple people. But I see what the texter is getting at. How do you make sure, Janet, that everybody's happy?
Well, I think what the texter is overlooking is that he would have help in keeping those ladies happy because they would also have other people in their lives to help him with that task. One of the things that shifts when you open up relationships beyond monogamy is there is the opportunity to, use is the wrong word, to have other people in your life that help with your different bits. If you like to go bowling, you don't have to go bowling with your spouse. You can go bowling with your lover. If you like to have a particular kind of sex that your primary partner does not enjoy, then you go find somebody else who likes that kind of sex. A lovely thing that happens in open relationships or consensual non-monogamy is you get your various lovers and partners collaborating to make you happy. I have seen so many times all the various partners get together to give a party for the central person's birthday so that they have everything that they want for their birthday or, you know, whatever. My co-author a couple years back had a very, very major surgery on her spine. And because she has spent, she just turned 75, she has spent most of her 75 years poly, there was a circle of friends and lovers and ex-lovers and ex-lovers' lovers taking care of her so that she never spent a minute alone until she was well enough to be left alone.
Crystal, I'd love you to respond to David, who wrote on our Facebook page, "In my experience as a non-poly person, the poly people I've met on dating apps have a very different view of emotional connection. My question is it difficult to feel beholden to many? Is the quality of the connection the same as the connection a monogamous couple might have, where the choice to be connected and intimate is reserved for just one person? Is it just more realistic to know that we can't imagine that only one person can satisfy all our needs?" Crystal?
Well, this might be a bad question for me to answer because I'm on the autism spectrum, so I don't have as deep emotional connections with my partners as others do. I do consider polyamory a way to get your emotional needs met with multiple people because there are some people who are need a shoulder to cry on, and my partners know that I'm not that person. So they have other people that they can turn to. When one person needs something, they can always go to their network of people. So Polyamory has to be a way of getting your needs met, but it also requires you to have a very specific idea of how you can meet other people's needs.
Well, Crystal, thank you for being honest about that. I know you did not owe us that information, but I appreciate you sharing that perspective on it. Eli, what would you say to David in the last few seconds we have left?
I would say that a lot of people in consensually non-monogamous and polyamorous relationships have intense emotional intimacy, in part because they have to think so deeply about who they are and what they want and how to structure their relationships and talk about it a lot. So I think that they develop very strong connections. And let me just say super briefly about the kids. I've been following children from polyamorous families for the last 20 years, and a lot of those kids are in really good shape with all of the attention they get from polyamorous families. And the race and class privilege of having white, highly educated parents helps. Not that all poly people are white, but a lot of the people in my sample are.
And Janet, for people who are just stepping their toe into polyamory or ethical non-monogamous relationships, what's the first thing they should keep in mind as they explore? Very briefly, before we go.
They will make mistakes, and they should have a game plan in mind for when it happens, because that's not an if, that's a when. Understanding that there will be miscommunications as you learn how to do this new skill, you just have to. If the first time somebody does something wrong, everything blows up. That's a problem.
Janet Hardy, the co-author of The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships, and Other Freedoms in Sex and Love. Elizabeth Sheff, the author of The Polyamorist Next Door, Inside Multiple Partner Relationships and Families. Crystal Farmer, a member of Black and Poly and the editor of blackandpoly.org. And Ron Young, the founder of Black and Poly. Thank you all for being with us. This conversation was produced by Jonquilin Hill and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.